This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing it and drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Now here's your host, Connor McKnight.
Welcome in to White Sox Weekly, the 20th of April, 2024. White Sox and Phillies coming up tonight. Game two of a three-game series there. White Sox dropped the first one 7-0. Another tough night for the White Sox offense against Spencer Turnbull, Matt Stram, and Orion Kerkering out of the Phillies bullpen. Garrett Crochet got touched up a little bit. We'll spend the first portion of the show talking about Crochet. We knew there'd be ups and downs. He's human after all. But after four really great starts, this one, the biggest bump in the road so far, and Alec Boehm made it hurt. That's what last night was. A couple of things go the other way, and maybe you're looking at a different start. At least that's where maybe you hang your hat. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number here on White Sox Weekly. A lot of good stuff for the White Sox, really, over the last week and a half or so on the pitching side of things. The offense does continue to confound, but we'll work through that as well. We'll talk to White Sox starter Jonathan Cannon a little bit later on here in the show. He made his big league debut just the other day. Pitched well, too, did Cannon. Even though the White Sox lost that game 4-2, Cannon got a no decision. 5 innings, 1 run, 1 walk, 3 strikeouts, and a home run allowed. Every now and again, you're going to give up a dinger, and when it's going to happen to you. With Cannon, though, given the expectations, given the lineup he's facing, the Royals really banging it coming into that ballgame, I thought he pitched really well. And Nick Nastrini made a start for the White Sox 2 days before that. It was the first time in White Sox franchise history, well, since 1932 at least, that two rookies had made their big league debut in consecutive starts. Pardon. It's got me all worked up. But I think what that says to you is that we are nearing, and really in the era of this regime, this White Sox front office, these young players pushing now to remake what had stalled out in the first rebuild and 21 and 22 and 23 over the last couple of years. And for one, or for myself rather, I've been really encouraged in what the pitching infrastructure has been able to create and refine a little bit here over the last few weeks. I think when you've got young starters coming up into the rotation, that there's kind of two things that go on in your brain these days. And the idea that there's no such thing as a pitching prospect because pitchers get hurt so often is a tough idea to shake. But when you've got a number of them, when, like the White Sox, in their system, nearly half or maybe even just over half of their top 30 in that system are pitchers, what you're doing as a franchise is kind of building up some needed redundancy so that you can get 6, 7, and 8 deep in a starting rotation in a year where you believe you can contend down the line here, and that way you can feel a little bit like, or you can see how it works when you get to a team like the Dodgers, who just keep on calling up arms that understand how to work their 2, 2.5, or 3 pitches against certain batters, find matchups, and then, you know, kind of get your player dev stuff to get a bullpen ready to go and take the rest of the ball game. I'm really encouraged by what I've been seeing pitching side from the Chicago White Sox so far. And really, Garrett Crochet is as much of that as anything else. We'll get to that in just a minute, but you should head to the ballpark next Saturday, April 27th, as the White Sox take on the Tampa Bay Rays at 6:10 p.m. The first 20,000 fans in attendance will receive a White Sox hockey jersey presented by CIBC. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. No lineup out for the White Sox yet for tonight's ballgame. We've got a 5 o'clock, or rather 4:30 pregame show with a 5:05 first pitch right here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Big start for Michael Soroka. Needs to get it in line. He's 0-2 with a 6.98 ERA. He has nibbled around the strike zone a little bit in his last couple of starts, and he's talked about it after those starts, really wanting to attack the strike zone more and get out of his own head a little bit. I'm paraphrasing some, but that is kind of what he talked about after his last start. Zach Wheeler is going to go for the Phillies, and he's a darn good one. If you need to know anything about Zach Wheeler, or I guess about how we record wins and losses in this game, I say it a lot. Wheeler's record is 0-3 if the pitcher win-loss thing does anything for you. Wins and losses for pitchers don't, starters at least, don't do anything for me. Zach Wheeler's one of the best in the business. He's holding a 3 ERA with 30 strikeouts so far. I can give you the 1-9 for the Phillies, although, you know, I mean, it's a visiting squad, and they're going to roll them out there a little bit like they did last night. Kyle Schwarber, Trey Turner, Bryce Harper, JT Realmuto, Alec Bohm, who just absolutely got two of them against Garrett Crochet last night. Brandon Marsh, Nick Castellanos, and then their 8 and 9 hitters this evening are going to be Bryson Stott, and then in center field, Johan Rojas will take the at-bats. Christian Pache was there last night. And as I mentioned earlier, still no lineup for the White Sox yet, or at least if it has been posted, it has just been posted, and I've not seen it yet. But rest assured, as soon as we do, I'll read it to you here, and we'll kind of break down what happened. Last night with the White Sox and Garrett Crochet making that start on the road against the Phillies in a hitter's ballpark against a lineup that knows how to bang, it did not go well. Three-plus innings, 5 hits for Crochet, 7 runs, 2 walks, 3 strikeouts, and 3 home runs. Things started off innocently enough for Crochet in the start last night. He got Kyle Schwarber to strike out swinging. There was an infield hit by Trey Turner on a ball to, you know, right in this 5.5 hole where Braden Shumake from third base comes across and in front of Paul DeJong. It's a play where typically, if the third baseman can make a play to his left, if he can cut that ball off, you want him making that play because his momentum is carrying him toward first base, and that's going to be a quicker release of the baseball. It's going to be a better chance to get an out, especially on a slowly hit ball. The shortstop going to his right is going to have to circle that ball a little bit or make a really athletic jump, stop, turn kind of play in order to get some weight behind that baseball and get a good throw on. You can see how that's a much more difficult play typically for the shortstop to make than the third baseman who's already going toward first. Problem on that play was Trey Turner can absolutely fly. That puts pressure on a defense. And Braden Shumake just couldn't quite find the handle fast enough to get it out of his mitt and over to first base. Runner on, Trey Turner. What we talk about all the time is that base runners are pressure. Guys on are pressure. And I won't say necessarily that, you know, Garrett Crochet's feeling that pressure. Don't know that he had his best stuff anyway. You look at some of the pitches that Alec Bohm took out of there. And, you know, it's a fastball up on the first one. It's a breaking ball that kind of hangs across the plate a little bit more than snaps when we see Garrett Crochet really throwing the good stuff in the second home run he gave up. But he walked Bryce Harper, the batter, after that infield single to Trey Turner. And you could just kind of tell things started to pile a little bit. He gets JT Realmuto looking to strike him out, two away, first and second. And here's a turning point in this game, right? I mean, yes, the whole thing happened almost exactly like it did in the first inning, again in the third. But if he's able to make a pitch or two, and really the home run, like we mentioned, that Bohm hit in the first inning, wasn't a terrible pitch. The fastball was up and out of the strike zone. The radar gun said 97. Bohm was able to ride it out to right field. He was looking up there. And whether or not that's exactly where the pitch wanted to be, where Crochet and Maldonado wanted it to be, whether that's a little bit of a miss of the spot or what have you, you know, they talked about it a little bit after the game, and I think you're going to hedge your bets some when you talk about that particular pitch. I think you kind of are usually, after a night like that where you have given up 7, you're tipping your cap and you're going back to the workshop, right? You can hardly fault him for making post-game comments like that. But again, it's entirely possible that given the way Crochet has pitched coming up to that, you throw that 97 up and away to the right-hander Bohm, and maybe that's just a pop-up to Sheets out and right. It's a really good swing on an okay pitch. Certainly not a pitch that's going to get a three-run home run going oppo taco every single time. He gets Nick Castellanos to get out of the inning, and in the third, all over again. After a 1-2-3 second, in the third inning, all over again, it's a strikeout of Schwarber to start. Trey Turner laces one down the third baseline. Very nearly could have been foul. Walks Bryce Harper again. Gets Real Muto to pop out. And Alec Bohm takes a slider. This pitch, definitely a mistake. One that just didn't quite break enough and ran right into the barrel of the right-hander Bohm. And a three-run homer. So just like that, six RBI for Alec Bohm. Crochets reeling, gives up a home run to Whit Merrifield to start the fourth. He gets pulled after the homer to Merrifield. Clearly just kind of, you know, out of gas, a little demoralized. You understand it, right? It's kind of the first blow-up start of Garrett Crochet's very young career. And everything up to this point, even his last start, which did not look as good as his others, still some positives there. He had one inning where he gave up five, and if a couple of pitches go his way in terms of strikes called, I don't think that's a five-run inning. I think it's a lot less than that, maybe two, and he's hanging in there longer. I think because Crochet is what he is, right, this kind of unknown anathema, a guy who had been a reliever, jumped past the minor leagues because of the pandemic and a triple digits fastball into a bullpen for a team that was contending, then has Tommy John, then some setbacks, then says, I'd like to be a starter. The White Sox say, okay, let's see a try. And then he blows away major league hitters for the better part of three starts. He draws a ton of interest. And it's outsized, too, because of, unfortunately, the lack of bats that the White Sox have to this point. The offense has been shut out seven times to start the season. So the focus goes on the pitching. And if Garrett Crochet can be a number one, this whole situation looks a lot different in that case than it does otherwise. Now, I don't think one start, especially against the Phillies, and especially given where Garrett Crochet is at in his major league starting career, says one thing or another. But what we knew coming into this season for Garrett Crochet, if nothing else, we knew that there'd be ups and downs, and maybe the most interesting and telling thing about whether Crochet had the stuff to be at the top of a big league rotation or in the middle or not in one at all, you know, anywhere on that spectrum, was going to be how he bounced back after starts that did not go his way. There's going to be a learning curve, regardless of how many big league hitters you've set down, the kind of stuff you have, how many starts you've had. I mean, you look on the other side of town right now, and a guy who's been doing it for the better part of a decade, and Kyle Hendricks, is having his own struggles. His velocity's fine, the stuff isn't there, and he's getting hit left and right. But that happens to every starter in Major League Baseball at some point in time. And right now, it looks like it's Garrett Crochet's chance to fight through it a little bit. Now, I wonder whether or not the White Sox, and this schedule may not allow them over the next week, week and a half, or perhaps it sets up perfectly, who knows, to get Crochet a little bit extra rest. And in order to do that, you've got to lean on some youngsters that have just made the ball club here over the last few days. We'll talk about Nick Nastrini. We'll talk about Jonathan Cannon when we come back. They have made their debuts and aced both of them. We'll get into the youngsters on the other side of a quick break. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number. I'm Connor McKnight. You got White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000.
Cannon home on a 1-2, and he got him swinging. He kind of got Salvi into swing mode, and he got him on a sweeper that was about a foot off the outside. So his first career strikeout comes against a guy with 250 career home runs.
That was game one of the doubleheader against the Royals. Len Casper, of course, with the call. DJ was there as well, and they watched Jonathan Cannon spin a really good major league debut. Five innings of work, one run, one walk, three strikeouts. That first one of Salvador Perez had him in a 1-2 count and got him to end that at bat. It was really fun watching Cannon pitch and watching Nick Nastrini work 2 days before that. He had the first game of that series. And, you know, when we're talking about those two kids and how they relate to Garrett Crochet and kind of the rest of the pitching infrastructure for the White Sox, I think they're integral. I think they're probably the most fun things to watch, too, right? we'll probably see Mike Clevinger come up and pitch for this team at some point in the beginning of May. We'll talk more about him and Tommy Pham, who is part of the picture here as well, offensively, in a little bit. But you know what Clevinger is likely to bring, right, from a production standpoint. He is also not 24, 25, 22 like Crochet, like Nastrini, like Cannon, you know? So the players to grow on and grow with are those three in the rotation, not others, right? It's entirely possible that other guys, you know, rebound and reconstruct themselves a little bit, like Soroka or Fetty or what have you. But it's very clear, and you look around Major League Baseball, this is true of any team. It's the young kids on rookie deals that you can build around and supplement with some free agents or good drafting or player dev or however you'd like to look at it. But those are the centerpieces. And I think, too, when you hear from Jonathan Cannon, and I think you'll hear from him right around 3:45 or so, we'll hear from Jonathan Cannon. He'll be our guest on White Sox Weekly. Scott Merkin of MLB.com coming up at 3:30. I think it'll become more evident that how he thinks about pitching, you know, what he's trying to accomplish and how he thinks about pitch shaping is really new age stuff. He is right there in terms of the refinement of that arsenal. And he's kind of had to be, as Jonathan Cannon. The guy was using 6 pitches at the University of Georgia and in his first season in the White Sox minor league system. And last year was a big editor, I think, of his pitch arsenal. You can throw all those pitches against minor leaguers when you've got an advanced approach and a good feel for the strike zone because you're kind of playing with them a little bit, right? It's kind of man amongst boys in a certain way. Cannon went to Georgia. He's got a great feel for the strike zone. He can make the ball do a lot of different things. And whether any one pitch is top tier matters less when you're facing the kind of pitchers that you're going to hitters that you're going to face through the minor leagues. You can kind of get away if you had a day. I'm just kind of making up as I go here, but if you had a day where Cannon had all of his stuff at a B level or whatever, a 60 grade level, a 50 grade level, you can work it because you can sequence it and make it all kind of feel the right way. You don't necessarily have to have one 80-grade pitch to get yourself into the bigs, but to stay there, more often than not, you do have to have something that's really outstanding, even if it is just one pitch and the rest of it kind of works off of that. There are those who get it done with an assortment of real solid stuff, with your 65-grade stuff, with your 60-grade, you know, pitches here or there. And we're talking about it on the 20 to 80 scouting grade scale. I read about it once, why we use a 20 to 80 grade scale, and for the life of me, I can't remember. It's archaic and old and weird. And if you want to read about it, you should read a Keith Law article or a Jonathan Callis article or a Jim Callis article or something like that. I know they've written about it. Or ask Len about it tonight on the broadcast. I'm sure he can remember. But for the life of me, it escapes me. But we use the 20 to 80 scale, with 80 being top tier, elite, best of the best, and 20 grade being much less than average in Major League Baseball. Anyway, when you've got a guy like Cannon, and we're going to talk about this some with him in just a little bit, the pitch mix is so crucial to how you get hitters out. With Nastrini, it's a little bit different. You can rely on that fastball that grades out a lot better than Cannon's does in terms of a velocity, in terms of a vertical attack angle and stuff, and just kind of let that blow away hitters and surprise them a bit with a good slider and very good change. And when it comes to Nastrini's start, you know, his first of the season, I had kind of, you know, in reading through the scouting reports and seeing him a little bit in spring training, I had started to think of him as a fastball slider guy, right? That was kind of the lean. And in watching the changeups that he threw in his first start, I was reminded that, oh no, that changeup was a very well-graded pitch when he was traded from the Dodgers to the White Sox last season, and that feel for a changeup in a lot of different spots was something that had scouts thinking, well, even though this guy and all pitchers have some relief, some danger to becoming a reliever, right? It's always a question as to whether a guy is a true starter or is going to need the bullpen because the mechanics are a little wonky, or really only has two pitches to work with, or command is so spotty that he can't last through a whole start. You know, those are the sorts of things that take pitching prospects and move them out of the rotation and into the bullpen. And Nastrini's got a little bit of relief risk to him as well. But with that kind of feel for a changeup and that kind of fearlessness in throwing one, I think there's a more pitchability there than other prospects that might look like him, and I give him a really good shot to make this rotation long-term based on that pitch alone, or the willingness to throw that pitch too. As those two tie into Crochet, I think if you look at the schedule for the White Sox here over the next, call it week and a half, they're in Philly here through Sunday, at Minnesota through Thursday, at home against the Rays next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday next weekend, and at home against the Twins Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So we're in the middle of our longest stretch of baseball here. No off day for the White Sox until Thursday the 2nd, which means that the White Sox need five in the rotation here, that they may have to go to a sixth man in the rotation. But because Chris Flexen had to come in and throw four innings in relief of Garrett Crochet last night, that may limit them a little bit as to who that sixth guy could be if they need the time for Garrett Crochet or for Nastrini or Cannon to get an extra day of rest before they're ready to go in that next start. That makes things a little bit difficult here over the next week and a half or so from the pitching standpoint. However, what's been really good outside of some of the starters has been the bullpen. Darryl Van Scowen tweeted this the other night. The bullpen over the last six games for the White Sox has been absolutely fantastic with a super low ERA. The kind of stuff that you go, well, if that's the way they want to pitch here, that'd be just fantastic. The bullpen over the last really six or seven games has been some solid stuff too. So while you don't want to have to lean heavily on your relievers, and you'd like to be able to turn things over to your starters for five, six innings, something like that, that's the preferable way of approaching this. But over the last six games, the White Sox bullpen has a 1.44 ERA, and over the last 13, it's a 2.82. So what this is right now is a team that pitches really well and has had one of the worst offensive starts in the modern era of baseball. It's unfortunate that way. It hurts on that side of the baseball a little bit. And to that end, the Sox may have some reinforcements coming over the next week or so. We'll talk about Tommy Pham and what he may bring and when he may bring it when we come back. Plus, the White Sox have just posted a lineup for their ball game against the Phillies tonight. So we'll get you the 1-9 for the Sox. Some big changes in this lineup as I look at it now, so don't go anywhere. We'll talk about it when we come back. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number. This is White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. I'm Connor McKnight. Take advantage of one of our best offers this season. Get one ticket and two beers to select games starting at $19 with Miller Lite Baseball and Brews. Must be 21 and over with a valid ID to purchase tickets. Visit whitesox.com/brews. When we left you, we were talking about the upcoming changes to the White Sox lineup for tonight's game and a veteran bat that could be with the Sox sooner rather than later. We will get to all of those things in just 10 seconds. We'll pause it here for station identification. So here's the lineup for tonight. Pedro Grifol just put this out a few minutes ago, and I can bring it to you now. 1-9, this is a very different look. Nicky Lopez is at the top for the White Sox, a lefty stick at second base to get things started. Eloy Jimenez will DH and bat second. Eloy was hitting second in last night's ball game, a loss to the Phillies, 7-0. He has been in the, I'm looking back through my scorebook here, he's been in the fourth spot exclusively since coming back. He's only started two games since coming back off the injured list. Let's see. Third hitter, Gavin Sheets in right. Andrew Vaughn at first base. Andrew Benintendi in left. Paul DeJong at short. Dominic Fletcher in center field. Corey Lee will catch and bat eight. And Braden Shoemake will play third base and bat nine. So a bit of a shakeup at the top with Eloy staying in the second spot. I mean, to me, this White Sox lineup, as much as anything else, needs Gavin Sheets to continue what he's doing and Eloy Jimenez to get back to being the Eloy Jimenez that we have seen for long periods of time. It has been a star-crossed career, I guess, for Eloy Jimenez is probably a fair way to put it. No one wanted him to go up and over the wall and tear a muscle in his chest. An emergency appendectomy last season is absolutely no one's fault, but it cost him time. There has obviously been far too many injuries running to first base. Those are the fault of who? I don't know. Maybe there isn't any fault when it comes to soft tissue injuries when a guy's running to first base. The one thing I do know, and I know this, like in my bones, I know it. The preparation's been there. The work's been there. The support has been there to get Eloy back from whatever injuries that he's had. And the same goes for anybody else who's on the injured list right now, whether that's Yoan Moncada or Luis Robert Jr. I'm just talking about Eloy's because he's back in the lineup right now, active and as healthy as he's been. So this is it again falls to Jimenez as much as anybody else to be that consistent on-base guy, right? To be the guy who's got a good power swing and can hit for some average. I mean, these are things that Jimenez has done as a White Sox and in the past, and something that he needs to do here because the rest of this lineup up and down has really been searching for it outside of Gavin Sheets, who's been stinging the ball, and Paul DeJong, who's been having a good last couple of games as well. We'll talk about Andrew Vaughn here a little bit later on in the show when we talk with Scott Merkin at 3:30. That's another hitter that you'd really like to see jump back to the form we'd seen him in, even last year, though the last year was a bit of a down year, but certainly 2 years ago in 2022, that guy, that hitter, would be a very welcome addition to this lineup. Speaking of welcome additions to the lineup, it seems as though Tommy Pham is not too far away from joining the big league club. Read you a couple of tweets from Daryl Van Scowen earlier today. Daryl covers the White Sox for the Chicago Sun-Times and does a damn good job of it. He wrote these couple tweets about Clevinger and Pham and the expectations there. The expectation, he writes, when Clevinger was signed was an arrival around the first of the month. He's still in Arizona. Quote, he's on schedule, Pedro Grifol said yesterday. Throwing the ball really good. He feels good, so he's on pace. He's been in game action. Tommy Pham is there, meaning Arizona, as well. Grifol mentioned that Pham went 5-for-9 Thursday on the backfields and is doing pretty good. Then the Charlotte Knights, about 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago, the AAA team for the White Sox announced that Tommy Pham had been added to their roster as of today. So Tommy Pham, now officially a member of the Charlotte Knights, they'll play, let's see, the AAA squad for the Mets this evening, and there are no lineups out for that game yet. It is at Truist Field in Charlotte, the launching pad that is. I would imagine that if he's added to Charlotte's roster, if Pham is added to Charlotte's roster, that he's theoretically in Charlotte and there and available. Might be he's in transit and they just figured they'd put him on the roster because they had the open spot. Rosters aren't so rigid in AAA as they are at the major league level with the 26-man. So we'll see. As soon as that roster gets posted or that lineup gets posted, we'll let you know because we'd keep an eye on Tommy Pham, the 36-year-old major league veteran, who looks like he's going to be added to this roster sooner rather than later. How it'll fit with Tommy Pham in the fold is a bit of a mystery. Pham's a corner guy, you know, a left fielder or right fielder. And at 36 years old, obviously his you know, kind of the defensive ability of a guy like that tends to slope downward a little bit. He was an impact bat for the Arizona Diamondbacks last season, especially in the playoffs, was a big part of that offense moving the way it did through the National League side of the playoffs, a veteran presence who has been a guy that a lot of people have talked about in clubhouses, both on one side and the other of a coin. Came up with the Cardinals as a 26-year-old in 2014, had some eye issues that really afflicted him as a minor leaguer and has had some treatments and I want to say a surgery for a congenital eye issue that's afflicted him just vision-wise. And having gotten that sorted and I think kind of Going through a couple of different rounds of contacts, different types of stuff, has really helped him see the ball a lot better and helped him be the power bat that he has been over the last 5-6 years. Certainly in his last couple of years in St. Louis, in 2017, Tommy Pham finished 11th in MVP voting in the National League. Last season, all told, in 129 games split between the Mets and Diamondbacks, Pham hit .256 with a .328 on base and slugged .446. He hit 16 home runs with 68 driven in, 27 doubles. That's a major league bat, no doubt about it. An OPS plus of 111 for his entire year of play. If you're unfamiliar with OPS plus, 100 is average. Any points over that is a percentile point above the average major league hitter, and points below that are the same on the other side. So we shall see exactly when Pham comes up and what that does to the roster. I would bet that, I mean, here's the sad reality. Usually when you're talking about roster moves that are a few weeks out, you go, okay, well, is he going to take this guy's spot? Is it a platoon out there with Benintendi? He's a right-handed bat, so does that mean Sheets is going to move over to first and Vaughn needs some time away or what have you? And the reality is that baseball's baseball, and that sort of thing may have an injury or something like that that's going to resolve itself. I don't know. But as it stands, you know, he's going to need playing time. And as a 36-year-old outfielder, it's pretty clear that while he is here to help the offense, he's also here to probably help somebody else's offense. That Tommy Pham's best production for the Chicago White Sox in 2024 may be what he's able to get you in return come trade deadline time. And with the way that guys like Pham and Brandon Belt and even a couple other hitters have had to wait for their free agent contracts late in spring training, even into the year, it's more and more the case that teams who have gotten off to tough starts like the White Sox or weren't in the playoff picture, playoff plans in this season anyway, are signing some of those veterans and hoping for the seasons that they think they can have so as to flip them to teams that need them at the deadline, just like Pham was for the Mets headed to the Diamondbacks last season. 312-332-3776, that's the phone number. Rogers Park is where we find Greg. Now he's on White Sox Weekly. What's up, Greg?
Hi, Connor. Connor, I called you a few times last year, and I was very optimistic about the Sox, and I was wrong. But as a social worker and everything, I am a very positive person. First of all, I want to thank you for this, putting together a White Sox Weekly every week, even during the offseason, and making it available on podcast. Second, I still think guys like Sosa, Colas are outstanding ball players in the making. And I think once they get their light bulb turned on the right way, I think they're really going to explode. And I also think, too, yeah, it's an awful start, you know. But you figure one game at a time, they start winning and get a streak together. They can easily turn it around. It's a very winnable division. And the other thing is, too, people don't mention, is that guaranteed rate field can be very, very intimidating for opposition teams. Even with small crowds, once the Sox start getting a lead late in the game, and we Sox fans can make a big difference. The best ballpark to watch a baseball game, best food, best scoreboards. And, you know, I think we should get behind the team as the weather gets better. And we'll just see what happens. I hate the negativity. That's just me. I'm just a positive person. And thank you for all your hard work.
Greg, thank you for calling, man. Appreciate you. Thank you for your work as a social worker. That's an important calling in this day and age, to be sure. And yeah, like Greg said, each and every White Sox Weekly is available on podcast. Just download the ESPN Chicago app. There's your shameless plug. I hope you're right, man. I really do. I know that you're right about guaranteed rate field. When that place is rocking, it is absolutely rocking. Just a brief story here. I think back to the playoff game there against the Astros. Leury Garcia hits the home run late in the ball game. I think it was honest to goodness, I'd have to look it back up, only because here's the story. When playoff games happen at ballparks, usually the broadcast crew, right, if you're not literally on air, and I was doing pre and post for that game, you go down into the tunnels of a stadium or, you know, through the concourse or whatever. And my job after that game was to run onto the field and grab a player for a post-game interview to throw on with Len and DJ before we started the post-game show proper, right? So I was going to hand a microphone to whomever was going to be a hero of the game or what have you after the White Sox won it and go from there. And I was in the tunnel when Leury hit the home run. And, you know, we were – everybody's going back and forth. And, you know, I'm standing there next to Chuck Garfine. And I think Ozzie's, you know, a couple of people back behind me. And Ryan McGuffey's down there. And I remember us, you know, just kind of watching along. There are no television monitors in this particular tunnel where the press was all queued up and ready to go onto the field. So we're following along like one person's phone that can actually get the signal because, again, giant concrete tunnel isn't exactly conducive to a cell phone signal. And we're watching the MLB at Bat app as this is all happening. I mean, you think this job is glamorous, and yeah, sometimes it is. But sometimes you're in the bowels of a stadium hoping to hear the crowd explode so that you know something good happened for the team you're covering in a playoff game, which it's not exactly where I expected to be that night. So anyway, the homer goes off, and I swear to you, that is the loudest thing I've ever heard is Guaranteed Rate Field on that night, right after that homer. It was absolutely electric. And going out onto the field afterward with Sox fans going nuts and just losing it after that win was awesome. And I appreciate Greg for lighting a fire under that memory because that was a really good one. As to what this team needs to bounce back offensively, sure. I mean, one of the things that this roster offers to anybody who wants it at this point, unfortunately and fortunately, is playing time, right? These are the two sides of being 3-15 at this point, 3-16 with the loss last night to the Phillies, is that if you want to hit, I think you'll play. We've already seen that White Sox manager Pedro Grifol and Chris Getz, you know, to their credit here at this point in the season, they wanted to run out the best defensive lineup that they could possibly run out there. Rely on this pitching staff that has thrown really well, or at least well enough in a lot of spots. Rely on the defense, play close games, and win them. That's not been the case because the offense has not held up their end of the bargain. They've been shut out 7 times in 19 games, and that's the most in the modern era in the first 21 games. So, not good on the offensive side of things. So in order to make an about face, a change, a push for more offense, we've seen Gavin Sheets in right field in a couple of nights. And that's, listen, I've talked about Gavin quite a bit on this show because he's been such a topic of conversation for these White Sox over the last 2-3 years. And the moment that Eloy Jimenez went over the fence at Camelback Ranch in spring training a few years back, Gavin Sheets and Andrew Vaughn got called on to learn right field. And both of them worked their butts off to become the best outfielders they could be. Now, for Vaughn, that wasn't so good. And moving back to first base was always going to be in the long-term plan. But that's not Andrew's fault that he wasn't able to turn himself into a four outs above average right fielder. Gavin Sheets has turned himself into a guy that can keep his head above water. And I mean that as a compliment. I really, really do. He's learned how to make his athletic profile, whatever that is, into a solid right fielder. There are balls out there that he's not going to get to, though. He's not a quick turn going back to the wall. He's not got good straight line speed. So all those things are going to limit just how good a right fielder you can be. But I think you really have to credit Gavin for doing the work he has to get to every ball he can. You know what I'm saying? I think there's a big difference there. That said, putting Gavin Sheets in right field drops your overall quality of that outfield from left to right, and you already have with Luis Robert out for the foreseeable future for the next couple of weeks. So when you've got an outfield like tonight that's going to go Benintendi in left, Fletcher in center, and Sheets in right, you are not, I mean, quite frankly, running out the best outfield that you can. You are sacrificing some of that defensive ability for on-base ability for Gavin Sheets' bat at this point. And I credit the White Sox for making that change because it is very clearly the change that needs to be made. This offense needs to get lifted some. And Pedro Grifol has determined that Jimenez, Sheets, and Vaughn as his 2-3 and 4 hitters tonight are the way that offense is going to give him the best chance against a really tough righty in Zach Wheeler. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number on White Sox Weekly. We'll talk a little bit more about this offense when we come back. Scott Merkin of MLB.com is going to join us at 3:30, and White Sox rookie Jonathan Cannon is going to join us a little later after that. I'm Connor McKnight. You got White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Start your game day with a pregame patio party, 2 hours of an all-you-can-eat drink and buffet, starting at just $63 per person. It is the best value in the ballpark for food and fun and excitement. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. I'm Connor McKnight. You got White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. We are a little over an hour away from the pregame show, White Sox and Phillies, coming up tonight. Michael Soroka for the White Sox, Zach Wheeler for Philadelphia. We had the lineups released about a half an hour ago. Read them to you then, but there's a change at the top. Nicky Lopez is going to get his first crack at the leadoff spot this season. Eloy Jimenez, Gavin Sheets to follow. Andrew Vaughn, Andrew Benintendi at first and left, respectively. Paul DeYoung's got short again. Dominic Fletcher in center field. Corey Lee will catch, and Braden Shumake is at third base. I want to get to a little bit more of the offense and also play you some of the comments that Garrett Crochet made after his start last night. It was a toughie. 7 earned against the Phillies, and 6 of those 7 on 2 different 3-run home runs to Alec Bohm, the third baseman for the Philadelphia Phillies, who has really come into his own as a big-time power threat, hitting .258 with an .834 OPS now and 3 home runs on the season, 2 of them last night. 17 runs driven in, too, for Bohm. You do that when you pop a sixer. The thing about this White Sox offense right now is that, yes, many are struggling, right? I mean, I'm looking up and down the batting averages, and no, I'm not saying the batting average is the end-all, be-all measurement of whether or not you are a good hitter, but just kind of going through the lineup right now, Lopez at .178, Eloy at .095, Sheets at .250, Vaughn at .159, Benintendi at .164, Paul DeYoung at .262, and if you looked at it 3 days ago, it was closer to .160. He had that really nice, I think it was 4-for-4, was it a 5-for-5 the other night for Paul DeYoung? He had reached 5 times, I think it was 4-for-4 plus the walk, and then he had 2 hits 2 nights ago, 2 ball games ago against the Royals, I should say. We had the off day. And then Corey Lee hitting .241, and Braden Shumake at .179. You've got Corey Lee in the lineup tonight, and while Martin Maldonado has been pretty impactful when it comes to working with the pitching, right? I mean, you can at the very least say that some of the stuff that the White Sox starters and relievers have said about Maldonado have been positives and things in the right direction. The bat has not been there for Martin Maldonado. He did have a hit last night, or a walk last night. He was 0-for-2. He has had a double. He's really struggled with the bat. And it wasn't something that was going to be his calling card one way or the other. I mean, it's not like Maldonado has ever been an offensive powerhouse. And yet, with the injury to Max Stassi, who was signed to be the backup catcher or maybe even a timeshare with Maldonado at the beginning of the offseason, you know, Stassi has had the setback with the hip injury, and Pedro Grifol has been fairly coy about just how long that injury may affect Stassi. He was placed on the 60-day IL a few days ago, Stassi was. And some of that's administrative, right, to clear up a 40-man roster spot for the youngsters that have been added to this team, and Jonathan Cannon and Nick Nastrini. You needed a spot. You had to take – it was clear that the White Sox wanted to move one of those injuries to the 60-day as opposed to expose one, someone from that 40-man roster to waivers. The Sox had – you know, I don't mean to speak ill necessarily of any one player, but with the players that they've already designated off the 40-man being snapped up in other places, guys like Alex Spies, the Sox have a full 40-man, a 40-man roster where each and every one of those guys is going to either matter depth-wise for you at this point or at some point in this season, or are guys like Brian Ramos and Colson Montgomery, who obviously aren't going anywhere and could be future long-term infielders for this team. So, you know, those guys aren't going off the 40-man. They're going to get snapped up, right? It's just not going to happen. So the Stassi move is able to free up a spot that way, but it also takes away, you know, kind of a league average catching bat that the White Sox were hoping to have. Corey Lee has been swinging it fairly well. He's taking certainly better at bats than Maldonado is at this point. And it's kind of this difficult, you know, chicken and egg sort of thing where, well, do you put Corey Lee in for the offense or does that compromise a little bit of what the pitching has been doing? Martin Maldonado signed a big league deal to be here and be the starter. Is that something that Pedro is struggling to juggle right now? Is that a difficult decision to make? Is Corey Lee playing well right now because he's being thrown into advantageous situations and the White Sox are finding the right matchups for him? I think that's part of it at this point. I think back to Andrew Vaughn's rookie season and Tony La Russa's ability to find the right matchups for Vaughn to the point where in the first 2-3 months, things look great for Vaughn. And I remember a lot of White Sox fans were thinking, oh, we want to see him more. He should start every day. I don't care what it takes. Let's move some things around and put Jose Abreu in the DH spot and Vaughn at first, if that's what it takes. And instead, what La Russa showed was a good deal of restraint and a lot of patience with Vaughn. And I think that really helped his development. Now, things have gone in a different way over the last year, but that start was a good one, and I think managing Corey Lee in a similar fashion could absolutely help his own development. Real quickly here, before we get to Scott Merkin of MLB.com in just a few minutes, Garrett Crochet spoke to reporters after last night's tough loss, 3 innings, 7 earned. We hadn't played it for you yet, so I wanted to play it for you now. Here's Garrett.
But I just kind of chalk up the entire day as not controlling the counts, kind of similar to last week, falling behind early and kind of fighting for everything. I didn't feel like any of my mistakes got punished, but it was kind of just the fact that they were making me throw more pitches than I needed to. So it's kind of only a matter of time at that point.
Over 20 pitches in the first inning. Yeah, the pitch to Brown wasn't that bad.
I didn't think it was a bad pitch. He put a good swing on it. Was trying to go up and in. Maybe it leaked a little bit away. So, I mean, but yeah, he put a good swing on a good pitch, so got to live with it.
How was your stuff and your command overall today, would you say?
Not fantastic, but I mean, that's not really my game per se. I'm not a pinpoint guy. I just got to compete in the zone, and today I definitely could have done a better job of that.
That's White Sox starter Garrett Crochet after his start last night. We'll use some of those comments as a springboard when we talk to Scott Merkin in just a couple of minutes. The MLB.com White Sox beat reporter is going to be our next guest here on White Sox Weekly. It's ESPN 1000. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Sox fans, bring your pup out to the ballpark on Monday, April 29th for Dog Day, sponsored by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Grab a seat in the outfield and watch the Sox take on the Twins at 6:40 p.m. Limited availability. To purchase your specialty tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. That's whitesox.com/promos. Joining us on White Sox Weekly is our friend and yours, Scott Merkin, White Sox beat reporter for MLB.com. Scott, appreciate you coming on. As always, a pleasure to talk with you. Michigan. There, we've gotten it out of the way. What's the latest on Tommy Pham and Mike Clevinger with the White Sox? Let's start there.
That's so funny that you said that, because I was all ready to ask you if we were talking the Michigan spring game or the White Sox today. So you got it out of the way before I could even get to you.
That's how you got to handle it. That's how you got to handle it. Go Wolverines,
you know,
and hail victors,
you know,
and all of that
well.
Nonsense.
Yeah, Tommy Pham is, you know, at Charlotte. Charlotte announced that today through a press release. So I would guess, you know, he's, I don't even know. I would guess probably end of the road trip, right? Minnesota Thursday afternoon day game. So probably next homestand, he's back. Assuming everything goes well, and that's just purely a guess on my part. And then, you know, Clevinger, they talked about when they signed him. We were in, I guess, KC at that point. The Sox were in KC, and I was there too. They, Chris Getz talked about the beginning of the month, so that's coming very soon too. So, you know, they'll have some interesting decisions to make, because Brad Keller has been putting in work at Charlotte too. So they're going to have some options to choose from for their starting rotation in the very near future. And then, you know, Pham is the kind of guy who can really make a difference with the bat very quickly if things are, you know, all in line for him.
Let's keep it with the rotation for now. I mean, whether Clevinger is ready May 1 or May 2 or May 3, the White Sox have some options here. Keller's one of them that you mentioned. Crochet is very brand new to starting. You've got two right. rookies currently in the rotation. Is there reticence to go to a six-man rotation here to do something unconventional, to piggyback some starts? Would you rather see a rotation? How do you handle all of these, you know, suddenly major league ready arms while also balancing the fact that Crochet is Crochet?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because I asked, or one of us asked Pedro during spring training about six-man, and he did not seem in favor of that. And then I asked him last week when Cannon, or I think maybe it was after the Cannon start, but probably after the doubleheader, and he said it's a possibility. You know, he said it's something to consider, if nothing else. I don't even know if he went as far as possibility, but yeah, you could definitely do that. You know, let's face it, they're 3-16, right? And, you know, quite a piece away from any sort of contention right now. So you got to look as much as development mm-hmm. and giving these guys the best chance to grow with the team as you do with let's fight our way back into the AL Central, you know? So, you know, Chris Getz, when he talked to us last, said, you know, right now they're letting Garrett go. You know, they've given him extra days here and there. I think pretty much every start he's had. Maybe there's one that was on regular, you know, four days in between starts. So that's something to consider, you know, at some point, you know, just with his, I believe his previous innings high was 54 1/3 in one season out of the bullpen. So he's going to be hitting that in the not too distant future if things go well for him. So yeah, there's a lot of options. You know, you already have Crochet and Soroka and Fetty, and then Cannon and Nastrini, who were both great in their first start, and then Keller and Clevenger coming. You have Flexen, who did a great job out of the bullpen last night. So there are choices there to be made, and you know, maybe some other guys as the year goes on in their system who could challenge for a spot up there. Why am I blanking on his name? The young man they acquired, Drew Thorpe. In the Dylan Seastrait, who's been great for Birmingham through three starts. So, you know, there are some ways to look at things, and a six-man, even if it's for a short period of time, could be a good thing, and especially for a guy like Clevenger, who I know was, you know, doing work and working out. It's not like he came into this signing completely, you know, just having to build up. He was throwing already, but just in terms of game action, it might be able to kind of ease everyone in and then take some stress off some of the younger guys.
Talking with Scott Merkin, MLB.com, White Sox beat reporter. What sense do you get, just on the rotation side of things, about the preference the White Sox may or may not have toward getting some starts to, whether it be Clevenger or Soroka or Flexen back into the rotation? I mean, this team is 3-16 at this point, and those veterans may be more useful to the 2026 White Sox by way of what they bring back at the deadline than they are for whatever innings they put up. How do you balance the innings available, knowing that you've got to show teams what these guys can do, but right. like you said, development is also a big key here in 24 for the youngsters?
Yeah, I think Clevenger, Fetty, and Soroka will pretty much be in that system. You know, the thing you have to remember, too, though, is innings, right? Like we're just talking about Crochet.
Yeah.
So, like, if I had my preference, which I don't, they don't really check with me on anything, just to break some news there, you know, I would let Nastrini and Cannon just go, you know, just say, you're part of the rotation, let's go. You may have a start where, like, you know, what Crochet had last night, where you get hit, you may have a start where you give up one run over seven innings. Doesn't matter. You're our guy now. We're going forward. I don't get the sense that's officially it yet. I think they're going to give him a couple times through until, you know, both Keller or Clevenger are ready. Keller and Clevenger are ready, and then make a decision at that point. I think Keller has an opt-out at the beginning of the month, too, so that's something to consider. But I think it's all part of it. You know, I mean, you brought him up now, so, you know, you're not worried about service time, or if you even were worried about that, or it didn't seem like they were in this case. So now you have to figure out, like, what's good and what's enough and what's too much, I think, with these guys. And that's where some of the veterans come in. And, yeah, I mean, if things go well, there may be a market for a Soroka or a Clevenger or a Keller or whoever you have there at the or around the trade deadline. And they certainly all can help the younger guys, too. All, you know, guys who know pitching and can impart their wisdom on these guys who are just, you know, have one start under their belt and getting ready for the second one this weekend and Monday.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. I'm Connor McKnight, and with me is White Sox rookie starter Jonathan Cannon. Jonathan, appreciate the time, my man. Congratulations on an amazing MLB debut. You, I would imagine, have had a chance over the last couple of days to wake up and feel like it's real now. How does looking back at that big league debut feel just a few days removed?
It's been such a whirlwind. I mean, the last few days have gone by so fast, but it's just been such a special moment for me, my family, and just everyone kind of in my support system. But it's definitely felt a little bit surreal, but definitely exciting. It was nice to have the first one go well, and it was fun to be out there, be in Chicago, and it was definitely a dream come true.
When I was doing the post-game show, we're looking down on the field after the ball game's over, and I could tell that there were a lot of your friends and family there. I was wondering, as we were doing the show, though, because your prospective debut got rained out the day before, did you have a chance to get a few more people at the ballpark with the pushback of your debut?
So all those people were in town the day before, so it was pretty funny. I told them, I texted them when the game got canceled the night before. I was like, hey, guys, you might need to push back your flights because the game just got moved to 1 o'clock tomorrow. So they all were planning on flying out Wednesday morning, so they all had to push their flights back a little bit. But I think it was well worth it for everyone. I was super happy to see them all on the field after the game.
Yeah, that's probably, I mean, for your family, that's probably the easiest half hour on hold with an airline to change a flight ever, right?
Yeah.
So you guys got to go to Philly, saw you with the Rocky statue and all that cool stuff. What is the, now that you're a couple days in the show and a wily veteran, what is the coolest thing about being in the bigs that we don't know about? You know what I mean? Like the thing that you realize now that you have been in Major League Baseball for a couple of days.
I think it's really just all of the support systems within the organization, whether it's the trainers, the strength coaches, the video coordinators, the analytics guys, like the chefs, like everyone, like everything is just centered around you playing baseball. And that's like your main focus. You don't have to worry about a lot of the logistics stuff and stuff you might have to worry about, like coming up through the minor leagues. And I think that's definitely like the coolest part, is just the focus solely on just going out there and being able to perform your best every single night. And it's been very, very cool and very fun.
I'm not surprised that's as awesome as it is. I gotta feel like it's a giant exhale every time you go to work, knowing that almost everything else is taken care of by somebody whose job it is to make sure you can go play.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really takes an army, and there's an army of people here just trying to support us to make sure we can go out there and perform our best every night. So I'm very thankful for all those people. And I know that they work very hard to help us go out onto the field every night. And it really is awesome. That's really the only way to describe it.
So, Jonathan, I was looking at the scouting reports the last year or so that were coming out on you, and six-pitch mix is something that gets – it's like in your scouting report all over the place. And I think you were working with six while you were at Georgia. And I recall seeing an interview that you'd given about trying over this last winter to kind of narrow that pitch mix or refine it some and change it a little bit. What exactly do you feel like you're working with right now? What's kind of the evolution of your pitch mix been over the last, I don't know, call it since the winter?
Yeah, so sort of coming out of college, I had, I didn't have the best fastball. The velo on it was good, but analytically speaking, the shape of it wasn't great. And if I didn't put it in good spots, like it got hit pretty hard. And so I've played around with a ton of pitches, and I think that has given me a little bit of an advantage, just from the sense of, because I've thrown so many, like I have really good feel for the ball and how the ball is moving. And so when I spoke with the White Sox over the offseason and going into spring training, we really talked about, and this had a lot to do with Brian Bannister coming over and talking with him about pitch mixes and sinkers and everything. And it was really narrowing the focus down to a sinker, a cutter, a changeup, a sweeper, and the occasional four-seam fastball. And it's a very similar mix to Logan Webb, and Bannister worked with Logan Webb over with the Giants, and so I've watched so many Logan Webb highlights over the last couple months, seeing how he approaches hitters and get guys out, and really tried to focus on that mix. Where last year I was a little bit more kind of all over the place. I was throwing a curveball, a slider, changeup, four seam. Like it's very, very difficult to keep all those pitches sharp, and simplifying the mix was very beneficial to me in terms of my plan of going after hitters.
And it's really interesting you brought up Webb. I got a chance to call one of his games. I think it was last season. And I remember thinking, man, this guy seems completely unafraid to throw anything in any quadrant of the strike zone, save for, I don't know, maybe that, you know, kind of breaking ball in and down to the lefties or something like something fairly obvious, right? Is that kind of the goal, essentially, with your mix, that you can get to the point where the command and control lets you throw anything to any spot?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's when it comes to just this particular mix with the sinker and the cutter, I think there's a lot more point of emphasis on command as compared to someone that throws like a really high velo, high vert, four-seam fastball, where you're really just kind of looking to be like in the upper quadrant. But with the sinker and the cutter, like these hitters are so good, you got to be very fine with where you're throwing to. So that command to the glove side, to the arm side, trying to keep things out of the middle of the plate is very important. There's a huge emphasis on that. So I would definitely agree that it's just learning where to throw pitches, like where pitches play, and that can sometimes change hitter to hitter. But the big emphasis on the scouting report, figuring out like where do we want to live here? Like, do we want to live down and away, up and in? Like where are we going with pitches?
I was reading that you are the first pitcher from the 2022 draft to make the major leagues. Had you heard that before, and what does it make you feel to know that?
I heard it for the first time the other day. I did not know that before. But I mean, obviously, I think it's a testament to both myself and the White Sox and developing me and really giving me a clear path to the big leagues and telling me like, hey, like this is what you got to do. Like this is what you got to work on. This is what we want to see. And I think I feel so blessed to be in this spot already. I definitely knew that I could get up quick. I don't know if 2 years ago that you told me I'd be up in April of 2024, if I would have believed you, but I knew I had it in me.
You come out of the Georgia program, which for those of you listening, if you're not a big college baseball fan, Georgia's what you call an absolute powerhouse. You had to know going there, though, that this was in the future for you, right? I mean, it's kind of a different mindset than somebody who goes in as a freshman thinking, hey, if things go great, maybe I'll get, you know, a late round pick or something like that at best. I mean, this, I have to imagine, was always in the back of your mind, or in the forefront of your mind, I should say, that you can make the bigs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the primary reasons why I chose Georgia in the first place. I wanted a place where I could play against the best talent in the country, and that happens there in the SEC every year. They consistently have some of the best baseball teams, and I was able to really come in and develop myself really well, and that's a testament to the pitching coaches there, the guys that came before me. And I was really, like, if you saw videos of me throwing my freshman year versus videos of throwing junior year, like, it's a completely different person.
I'm looking through the rosters now from the 2022 squad. Charlie Condon, who is one of the top, if not the top, players in college baseball right now, is your teammate. He was a freshman when you were a junior. You get a chance to talk with him much? You stay in touch? I mean, this kid's absolutely ripping through the NCAA right now.
Yeah, he is one of the best hitters that I've ever seen, and he is so fun to watch. I tune into those games as much as I can, and watching him hit is very fun. I have no doubt in my mind that we will be back on the same field together sooner rather than later. And whatever team gets to draft him, I don't think there's any way he falls to us at pick five, but if for some reason he does, I hope we jump all over it because I would love to share a field with him again.
You're going to be calling the front office, telling him to run up with a pick, I feel like.
Yeah, I know I'd much rather have that guy in my dugout than in the other batter's box.
Jonathan, you're on the list of pitching probables coming up here against the Twins. I would imagine that the conversation between you and Pedro Grifol and general manager Chris Getz and Ethan Katz has been something along the lines of, this is your spot and you got a chance to stay here as long as your performance dictates. Is that kind of where things are at? Is that where your head is at, given that you got to start coming up against Minnesota?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really just kind of taking on a start-by-start basis. I mean, obviously, the first one is super exciting and have my whole family there, and it's the debut. Like, it's just the day that I've dreamed about for so long, but now it's kind of getting down to business and really just going start-by-start and just preparing myself for this start, trying not to look ahead too much and really just kind of stay in the present.
Jonathan, really appreciate the time, man. Best of luck against the Twins in your coming start, and enjoy every single second of it. It doesn't sound like that's a problem, though. This is awesome.
Yes, it is. I appreciate you having me on.
You got it. We'll be back with more White Sox Weekly. Big thanks to Jonathan Cannon for joining us today. We got the White Sox and Phillies coming up in just a little bit with Michael Soroka starting for the Sox and Zach Wheeler for the Phillies. More White Sox Weekly when we come back on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to win the best seats in the house. April's winner will get two Wintrust Scout seat tickets to three home games against the Red Sox, Rangers, and Mets. Enjoy the views directly by home plate, complimentary food and beverage, in-seat service, and VIP parking. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. Big thanks to Jonathan Cannon for joining us here on the show just a few minutes ago. Big thanks to Scott Merkin for joining us earlier and joining us again. We can't quit him. He's got good stuff on the White Sox. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for coming back with us.
We're back. We're back and better than ever.
That indeed we are. Hey, when we left, I was asking you a question about Drew Thorpe. I wanted to wrap up the pitching side of things for the White Sox, at least for today, before we shift over to the bats. And I was wondering, you know, we were talking about kind of the youngsters versus the veterans, the idea of the innings limits that exist on a number of these different starters. Do you think Drew Thorpe is the kind of guy that could make the bigs at some point this season? And if he is, I wonder whether the White Sox would skip AAA entirely with a pitcher like that because of A, who Drew Thorpe is in terms of a command and control guy, and B, how awful Charlotte can be for pitchers.
Yeah. I was just going to say, nothing against a beautiful ballpark, and Tommy Viola does a great job as a media relations guy down there, and the city is wonderful.
Doubt.
But yeah, I agree with you. I'm not one who thinks, like, I don't know how you feel on this kind of, but I don't think you have to go to every level I don't think you have to check every box to get there. I think if you're ready at Birmingham and showing you have that pitchability and that mindset and the skill to get at the big leagues, I don't know. I think it's more about innings and more about preparation, right? Then you have to show it at the next level too. I think, you know, you can go, we've seen guys make the jump from AA to the majors, not only just in the White Sox, but other teams and can handle it. So I think that's a possibility. I think they could do it. And I'm interested to see I've talked to him recently. I'm going to do a story this week on him. And that, you know, I think the plus about Drew is that he's considered by many to have the best changeup in the minors. The negative is he's not a hard thrower, which may not be a negative. Who knows, you know? Or I shouldn't say negative. How about the question mark is that he's not a hard thrower. So how does his stuff play a second and third time through the lineup as a starter? But he seems very confident and very nonplussed by that sort of question. He says this is how he's thrown his whole career, and I believe he led the minor leagues in strikeouts last year. So, yeah, Chris Getz, when they made the trade for Dylan and they got the four-player return, said that he thought, you know, there was a chance three guys from that deal. Stephen Wilson's already doing a great job in leverage situations out of the bullpen. Thorpe and Ariarte could help at some point in 24. I think Ariarte is a little further off, but I think Thorpe could definitely be part of the picture.
Talking with Scott Merkin of MLB.com. We're going to take a quick 10-second break for station identification and get into the offensive side of things for the White Sox. Here's 10 for ID. All right, Scott, listen, the White Sox have been shut out now seven times this season. Nobody's been shut out that many times in as few games. when you talk to whether it's Marcus Thames or individual hitters or Pedro Grifol, what's been the most common refrain about what's gone wrong to this point, and what's been the common refrain about how it needs to get fixed going forward?
I mean, what can be said at this point, right? I mean, you can only beat the horse so long, dead horse so long, right? I mean, I, on one hand, you know, two of their top offensive players, probably in terms of Robert and Moncada, are out until, you know, Robert another month probably, and Moncada until after the All-Star break, and that's hopeful on both ends. And then, you know, Jimenez is just coming back and doesn't look quite 100% yet, but he's out there playing, trying to help out. And then you have two other key offensive players in Vaughn and Benintendi who are off to, you know, miserable starts. There's no sugarcoating it. They're much better than what they're showing. You know, in talking to Marcus last Sunday, I think it was, I talked to him. He's just trying to keep their confidence up and try and convince them, you know, you can't get it. It sounds so cliche, but there's really nothing else you can do at this point. Is, you know, you can't try and get three hits with one at bat. You can't try and put all of it on yourself. They're looking for better at bats, cleaning up things a little bit more on the approach, and just letting the line take over. You know, you do your thing, let the next guy come and the next guy after that. And it's just not working right now. You know, they're the worst offense in baseball, and that's by a good margin. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to change anytime soon, aside from just the, as he said to me, which didn't go over huge, but, you know, it's true. He said, you know, not so much about the back of the baseball cards, because things change. Just because you were a 320 hitter 3 years ago doesn't mean you're going to get back to that level again. But these hitters in the lineup are not nearly as bad as what they're showing, right? I mean, you know, just law of averages, they're going to get better at some point. So you just got to hang with it and deal with the struggles. Now, one of the other things about the struggles is that, you know, it's at the beginning of the season where there's no base. So it looks, what's bad looks 10 times worse. And what's bad has been pretty bad so far. So there's no answer. I don't think there's like a mechanics answer or analytics answer that you do this and do that, aside from maybe not chasing as much out of the zone. But I think, you know, the approaches have been decent, just no results at all so far, aside from what Gavin Sheets and Paul DeYoung, and Paul's game has been better the last week, really. He had, what, 5 hits in the doubleheader Wednesday, right? So and Corey Lee has done decently off the bench. So otherwise, and Robbie Grossman, I guess, has had, you know, had some walks and worked some good counts up there, but they're just not getting production 1 through 9. It's they're all struggling at the same time.
I wonder, yeah, I mean, it's definitely early still, right? And a guy like Paul DeYoung can put 100 points on his batting average with a 5-hit day in a doubleheader against the Royals, no doubt about it. One of the things I was kind of wondering about earlier in the show was whether or not Pedro Grifol would make a short, medium, or even long-term switch in terms of his catching situation, right? Martin Maldonado doesn't hit. At his best, he's a great defensive catcher. Less than that, and he's still not hitting. Corey Lee has shown that he's got a little pop and a better approach, certainly, than he did last year. Can Corey Lee play himself into, I don't know, 4 days out of 7 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. They really like Martin Maldonado's game calling behind. But let's put this in perspective, too. Martin Maldonado was not signed for his offense. You know, they just didn't fit. I mean, he struggled. He has not been good at all so far. But he was not signed for that component of his game. They just didn't figure the rest of this lineup would be as bad as it has been so far. So he's there for his game calling, for the way he handles pitchers and that sort of thing. Now, I think Lee deserves an extreme amount of credit, because Lee, you know, was bad when he got caught up last year. He was 5-for-65 during his stint with the White Sox. And he went out, much like Gavin Sheets did this offseason, and said, that's not me. Found an approach that worked for him, shortened his swing a little bit during his offseason work, and it's paid off so far. Also, great arm behind the plate. He's been very accurate and very strong with his throws. So, yeah, I could see where they start getting him in there more, but I know they value Maldonado. They value what he brings behind the plate. People can scoff at that because he's just not hitting at all, but they really do value him behind the plate. So I don't think he's going to, you know, disappear completely, but they could make it a more 50-50 split if you can do 50-50 with 7 games or 6 games in a week. I guess you can't with 6, but not 7. But, you know, I do think they will mix Corey Lee in a little bit, because, again, we talked about before we got cut off, it's about development, too. You know, it's 3-16, and you got to develop, too. So that's all part of it.
Speaking of development, you know, Tommy Pham, we mentioned at the top here, is in the lineup at Charlotte. I actually just hit the refresh button. He's playing right field for the Knights tonight. So that is official. How does Tommy Pham fit here? You know, and what's the timing sense that you get of when Pham could be ready for Major League Baseball again.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know completely. I mean, he just went to Charlotte, so you got to figure, I mean, could he? Well, it's not going to be by the Minnesota series, right? If he just started Charlotte tonight, I can't imagine that it would be two games and he'll be back, because they're probably going to have to give him like a day off in there in between. But I could see at some point during the next homestand and maybe even next weekend against the Rays, right, where it would be possible that he could be in that lineup. And it is a weird combination, right, because – on one hand, they're a 3-16 team, and you want to get a look at the young guys, and you want to see who, you know, is going to be part of this next core, whether they call it or not. They're, you know, rebuilding, not to mention some of the younger guys in the system, but they've added some veterans too. And, you know, not in high end, but in Pham and Clevinger, and you see what, you know, what they can do too. And who knows, maybe they fit going forward, you know, as they progress here, or like you said, they could be someone they could move at the All-Star break, or I'm sorry, the trade deadline after the All-Star break, and get something returned. So I couldn't even hazard a guess yet on Pham, but I would say it's, you know, probably not too far in the distant future where he's going to be helping this team on the Major League roster.
Merck, appreciate the time as always. You are the man, and we'll catch up when we get back to Guaranteed Rate Field here next week.
All right, Connor. I like the bonus part of the interview too. It was a good move there.
It's always can do one more, that's for sure. Thanks again.
Thanks, Connor. Take care.
Scott Merkin, MLB.com, the White Sox beat reporter. Yeah, you know, I kind of pinned him there with a tough question at the end. Tommy Pham, in case you're just tuning in, was moved to the Charlotte Knights roster just today, and he is in the lineup playing right field for the Knights tonight against the Mets AAA squad. So it's really an interesting signing for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is the reputation that Tommy Pham carries throughout the big leagues. He has been part of a couple of different controversies, and up and down, many teammates will swear that he is not at all the guy he's been made out to be, given some of those outbursts. It's well documented on either side of things. That and a lot of teammates will say he's the kind of guy that's got that edge, that competitive side, that is a good thing when it comes to pushing a team to where it needs to be. Pedro Grifol was talking about that just the other day. I want to say it was the day before, maybe it was Monday, or maybe it was just before the rainout when Pedro Grifol had his media session there, something like that. Real recent future. Recent past, I should say. Recent future doesn't make any sense. And he pointed out that, like, listen, at this point, that kind of competitive fire can only be helpful for us. It's not going well, right? And I thought, well, yeah, that does make some sense. You know, if status quo is unfortunately being shut out seven times in 20-something games, if status quo is two runs a game, if it's strikeouts and not enough walks and not enough home runs and needing four or five hits to string together one or two runs, then yeah, go ahead and change that dynamic. But positionally, what Pham offers you is a very traditional corner outfield profile, which means that the guys who have either been the most reliable hitters to start the season, Gavin Sheets, Robbie Grossman, or the guys who are kind of entrenched in this White Sox roster by way of contract and player profile and back of the baseball card pedigree, Andrew Benintendi and Eloy Jimenez via the DH spot, those are the guys that would have to give up at bats to Tommy Pham in order to get him in the lineup. So whether you're talking about Andrew Benintendi taking a break for 2 days out of seven, and then the right field kind of combination that you have right now, taking a break for two out of seven. Oh, and I forgot to mention too, you know, if Pham were to go out there in right field and Benintendi's in left, and you want to keep Gavin Sheets in the lineup because he's swinging it, then Andrew Vaughn moves to DH and Jimenez sits, or Jimenez stays in the DH spot and Vaughn sits. I mean, that just has some domino effect to it, doesn't it? And while we knew that this White Sox season 2024 was going to be one of transition, was going to be one where the majority of the roster got changed over from 23, that a vast part of the pitching profile was all going to be different, save Michael Kopech, really, and many of these hitters were going to be very different players than they were last season, the idea of exchanging, you know, in the lineup, not talking about from a roster standpoint, but in the lineup, exchanging Tommy Pham for Jimenez, Sheets, Vaughn, Benintendi, that would have been pretty surprising to a lot of people just a couple of months ago. Not from a can Tommy Pham back up any of these positions, but from a position of can Tommy Pham start over some of these players. Unfortunately for the White Sox, that is the offensive start that this team has gotten off to. And those are the questions that we're left to ask, given the way this team has not hit and the signings that they've made in terms of Pham, and to a lesser degree, Clevinger, when it comes to the dominoes that may fall on the pitching side of things. It's just on the pitching side of things, with the innings limits that you're looking at and the unfortunate reality of the likelihood of injury to any one person at any point who throws a baseball in Major League Baseball, knock on wood that it's nobody anymore, that we're done with injuries from here on out through the rest of the season, maybe for the rest of time. I'm so tired of everyone's elbow exploding. I don't like that about our sport. It's my least favorite thing about the sport. Why can't everyone's elbow just stay intact? It would be so much more fun that way. Rant aside, it's just a different conversation when it comes to the pitching side of things and signing a veteran at this point than it is from the offensive side of things, because of the roster, the defensive limitations that I've kind of described here over the last little bit. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number here on White Sox Weekly. We got one segment left before the pregame show starts at 4:30, so just a little bit more time left for your phone calls. We'll get you all set for the ball game coming up in just a bit tonight. I'm Connor. It's ESPN 1000. Last little bit here on White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Sox fans, bring your family to the ballpark with a family pack presented by ExxonMobil, starting at just $19. Each family member gets one ticket, hot dog, drink, bag of chips, plus a cookie. For tickets, visit whitesox.com/family. That's whitesox.com/family. At the end of the last segment, I ranted a little bit, and it's about pitcher injuries because I don't like them. I'm done with them. I want the best of the best to be in this game all the time. I want to turn injuries off in Major League Baseball just the same way you can in the show or out of the park baseball or whatever. And I was reading through Twitter the other day and came across Twitter this afternoon, actually, and came across a really smart baseball writer, Travis Sawchuk. He's an MLB writer for The Score, not that Score, the online Score, the online entity, not the radio station. And Sawchuk has been writing for a long time for a lot of different outlets. He's a co-author of The MVP Machine with one of my other favorite baseball writers, Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer. If you haven't read The MVP Machine, it's well worth it. Some of it in there has aged, and Ben and Travis would be the first to say that. It's a lot about the Houston Astros and their player development system, and it did not involve the banging scheme, you know, where the Astros were hitting the trash can for a fastball and whatnot, because nobody knew about it when they wrote the book and published it. All that aside, Travis is a brilliant baseball writer and a guy that I follow for a lot of good nuggets, and this is one of them. He writes on Twitter just this afternoon, the Major League Baseball velocity range is shrinking. I dove into velocity range looking at all pitchers' minimum, maximum, and median fastball velocity since 2007. That's a lot of time. Pitchers are indeed max efforting more and more, and that probably has something or a lot to do with injury. Check this. This is the next tweet from Sawchuk. Greg Maddux, he writes, had a 14.5-mile-an-hour gap between his slowest fastball and his fastest fastball in 2007, which is to say that Greg Maddux threw a 79.5-mile-an-hour fastball at one point and also 94-mile-an-hour fastballs. That was his max effort in 2007. There were 69 pitchers who had a 10-plus-mile-an-hour gap between their maximum and minimum velocities in 2007. Boil that down, there were a lot of guys almost 20 years ago who were mixing velocities on their fastballs much more often. They could throw at 94, they could throw at 84. Still a fastball. And stands to reason you could do the same with the rest of your pitches too. Sawchuk continues on Twitter, Justin Verlander is a great example of this, and he's pitched throughout the entire pitch tracking era. He used to cruise at lower velocity, and that changed. It also led, perhaps, to a Tommy John injury. This is me kind of editing now. Led to a Tommy John injury in 2020 and 2021, where he had to sit out. I remember, and I think White Sox fans will as well, kind of painfully, Verlander used to sit right around 94, 95 or so. And then, inevitably, when he got deep into the game and was still cruising, he could be his own reliever and jump the fastball up. He still had 97 and 98 left in the tank late in a game to finish off hitters when he needed it. Not necessarily because he had sat right around 94, 95, but that probably helped. And also being able to reach back for that velocity late means you're offering hitters a completely different timing and rhythm that they've got to get on in order to get to you. DJ talks about this a lot, and he's a guy who came up in that Greg Maddux era, right? Greg was, I don't think he was a roommate of his on the road, but he was certainly a minor league teammate of his when DJ was in the Cubs organization. Greg Maddux was far from the only guy that was mixing velocities like that just on the fastball, to say nothing of the other stuff, because you know guys were doing that as well. But this is well measured now, and pitchers talk about this a ton. There's no reward anymore for throwing slower. Teams don't put those guys on the big league roster as often. And if you're right on the edge, the cusp of that 40-man roster, or if you're on that 40-man and working your butt off to get called up to the 26 or what have you, then being able to throw 97 eight or nine more times in a ball game and be more effective at that velocity is the thing that's going to get you to the bigs. It's the thing that's going to keep you in the bigs. But I would contend, and I think especially in light of all of the elbow issues that we're seeing and the surgeons who are operating those on those elbows talking about just how shredded these things are, how different they look now than they did even 10, 15 years ago, that we may need a change in baseball, and we may need it faster than we think. And while it's entirely possible that snapping your fingers and going all the way down to the youth levels of this sport and reteaching how we teach, relearning how we teach pitching, right? That we completely reinvent pitch limits and what velocity is and how we try and achieve it and how mixing velocities can help as much as anything else. That could all be well and good, and I'd love to be able to snap my fingers and do that. In fact, I absolutely would. It would still take years for those changes to hit Major League Baseball, right? Those 12-year-olds aren't going to be 22 and in the bigs tomorrow. So there needs to be a paradigm shift in how we think about pitching, and I wonder if some teams, maybe like the White Sox in their pursuit of Drew Thorpe and the trade of Dylan Cease, aren't looking for some of those pitchers because they can be effective and are safer. And after all, you can only produce for your ball club if you're on the field. It's really tough to do so from the training room. That's going to do it for us here on White Sox Weekly. We got the pregame show for the White Sox and Phillies coming up in just a couple of minutes. Big thanks to Jonathan Cannon, Scott Merkin, Jake Cantu, Brendan Riley. We got the pregame show next on ESPN 1000.